Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
This is the biggest ever signing ceremony of countries. They're expecting 130 countries to sign this agreement. And it will enter into force a month after 55 countries either ratify it or deposit their instruments of ratification.
That's VOA's Margaret Bashir reporting on today's signing of the new climate change agreement at UN headquarters in New York. Details coming up. Also, the Ethiopian military says today it has located the estimated 100 children kidnapped last week from Ethiopia. And senior U.S. government officials are urging Chad to take action to ensure long-term stability for the country and the region. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, leaders from around the world will be gathered together today at UN headquarters in New York for the signing ceremony of the climate change agreement that took place in Paris last December. The agreement's goal is to limit global temperature rises to the 2 degrees below Celsius, the benchmark that delegates and leaders agreed upon. The climate agreement is a roadmap for reducing carbon emissions and to mitigate the effects of climate change. VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir will be attending the signing ceremony. She spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis about the significance of the upcoming event.
We're expecting about 60 presidents and prime ministers to come to the UN on Friday, including President François Hollande of France, who was very instrumental in getting this deal signed. The Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, is supposed to be coming. And Hollywood celebrity Leonardo DiCaprio will be here. He's a very big climate change advocate, and so he's going to lend a little star power to the event. The UN is very excited about it because this is the biggest ever signing ceremony of countries. They're expecting 130 countries to sign this agreement. And it will enter into force a month after 55 countries either ratify it or deposit their instruments of ratification with the Secretary General of the UN. When they come and sign on Friday, they're committing to it, but then some countries have to go back and fight about it with their parliaments to make sure it's implemented so that they can ratify it. But some other countries are saying, we're bringing our instrument of ratification with us. So they'll be ready to go and begin as soon as the treaty enters into force. The agreement will be open for signature for a year.
Also, in covering the last conference in Paris, I spoke with many delegates who were saying that this particular climate conference is different from the others. Why do you think that they're saying that this particular one is different?
Well, I think there's really finally the political will and the recognition in the international community that something has to be done about climate change. People are seeing the real impacts of it. There are many more natural disasters, more floods, more droughts. They're seeing the effects of El Nino and El Niña. So they understand that it's real. And perhaps before, there were still a lot of people who were in denial about that. But now governments are understanding they need to do something about it, and they need to do something about it quickly because we could feel the effects of it even in this generation. You know, we're not talking about 500 years from now. We're talking about now.
What is the significance of the signing in New York at the UN headquarters, considering that the negotiations took place in Paris?
So the UN was a part of those negotiations, and the UN has its own climate change department, so to speak, and they've been very active in helping get this through. The Secretary General has made climate change one of his big issues. It will be part of his legacy when he leaves here at the end of this year, his term finishes. But he's also what they call the depository for treaties and international agreements such as this. And so when the countries sign them, they're then deposited with the Secretary General, and he becomes like the sole custodian of this treaty. So they're going to bring the one original copy of this very long agreement here, and the leaders, the foreign ministers, the presidents, the prime ministers, they will come and sign it. Then it gets deposited with him, and he becomes the guardian of it, so to speak.
Another aspect of this, in looking at the challenges that have been brought on by the recent and continued influx of migrants and refugees into Europe, do you think this will have any effect on countries there fulfilling their climate commitments?
No, and I think in some countries it may actually push people to fulfill it because, you know, in a lot of the African countries, people are leaving because of the drought and the famines that come from it and the food insecurity. So that might push the richer countries, the northern countries, to help mitigate climate change effects in some of the southern countries that are feeling the impact of it the most. In a lot of cases, those countries are contributing to climate change the least because they're not big emitters of carbon and other damaging things into the atmosphere. Also, they have money separate. You know, you have your budgets for different things. So I think governments can still pay for their climate change obligations, and it won't affect the migration and refugee situation. And also, the UN and governments are really trying to partner with the private sector on this. They realize they can't do it alone. And so there's been a real push to encourage industry to see that there's a benefit to them, too, in dollars and in good press and in all sorts of ways if they green the economy, if they are more friendly, more climate-friendly in the way they produce and manufacture and mine and do all their different things.
After the signing ceremony, then, what will be the next step for countries? Do you think they'll still be motivated to really just jump in and start making these changes?
They can start on their own, but for the agreement to actually come into force, we need those 55 countries to ratify it. Several have said they will ratify it directly, but I don't know how many that will be. I don't think it will be the required 55. That will take some time. And there's also another little trick to it. Those 55 countries have to account for at least 55% of total global greenhouse gas emissions. It may take a little while for this agreement to go into force, but I think there's definitely the political will for it to happen.
That was VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir. She spoke with Kim Lewis from UN headquarters in New York. The Ethiopian military says today it has located the estimated 100 children kidnapped from the country last week. Ethiopian news agencies reported that troops have crossed the border into South Sudan and have surrounded an unidentified town where they believe the children are held. Gunmen shot and killed more than 200 residents in the Ethiopian town of Jakwa last Friday. Officials in Addis say they are members of the Murel ethnic group from South Sudan. South Sudan says it is cooperating with Ethiopia's military. Acting Foreign Minister Peter Bashir Gabandi said South Sudan's army was not involved in Friday's attacks. The gunmen also stole about 1,000 heads of cattle in the raid. The Murel are cattle keepers who often steal livestock on both sides of the border. Baba Madan, governor of Boma State, where the Murel live, blames fighters of the Cobra faction, a former militia in the area, for the attack. The Cobra had rebellion going against South Sudan's government from 2011 to 2013. A spokesman for that faction denies responsibility. And Amnesty International has called on the Sudanese government to investigate the fatal shooting of an 18-year-old student by intelligence forces at the University of Kordofan on Tuesday. The death occurred during student demonstrations on the campus, in which 27 students were injured. The students were submitting the names of candidates for student union elections. School officials originally claimed the violence was a result of a clash between rival student groups. Ahmed El-Zabir is a Sudan researcher for Amnesty International in Nairobi. He talked to VOA's David Arnold in Washington about their call for an investigation in Khartoum.
Well, we received many reports from human rights monitors in Sudan. Most of these reports, there is one student was killed. There is about five other students seriously injured, and also another 22 also injured, but not by police, but by other means.
Now, I understand the original report did not involve anybody in the intelligence services, and your concern is that, in fact, the death may have been caused by intelligence people. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. Because most of the testimonies we received from the students themselves and from human rights defenders, we confirmed that the national security agents, they started shooting.
And what was the cause for the demonstrations in the first place?
Well, this is about the student union election. I think the date of the election was on the 19th of February. These opposition groups, they tried to submit their candidate list to the election committee as a student union. And I think they were prevented by the police. And I think this is not the first time to happen in Western Sudan. Last February, also students killed in Western Sudan in Darfur.
That was Amnesty International's Ahmed El Zobeir in Nairobi talking to David Arnold in Washington. Somalia's immigration department has banned Somali citizens from getting visas to travel to Europe following the tragic drowning of hundreds of Somalis in the Mediterranean recently. In other news, the NATO Secretary General said today efforts to stop migrants from reaching the shores of Europe are working. Jens Stoltenberg told a news conference in Ankara the number of migrants crossing the Aegean Sea is down significantly. On March 20, the EU signed an agreement with Turkey in which migrants who don't apply for asylum in Turkey before arriving on Greek islands will face deportation to Turkey. In that agreement, Turkey expects to receive visa-free travel to European countries, but Reuters reports that Ankara has met only about half of the EU's conditions for easier access to Europe. Sixteen past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A new report by a coalition of healthcare groups urges the U.S. Congress and policymakers to ensure a steady stream of funding to fight Zika, Ebola, and other neglected diseases. A Global Health Technologies Coalition study reports that U.S. funding for research and development nearly doubled between 2000 and 2010, but has largely been stagnant or declining since then. Aaron Will Morton is the group's director. Reporter William Eagle asked her the reason for the decline in U.S. financial support and what can be done about it.
Well, we have seen a decline or stagnation in funding since 2009, and I think one of the biggest reasons for that was the budget sequestration that happened within the U.S. government in 2013. And that really was detrimental for agency funding across the board and certainly made global health R&D take a hit in terms of funding levels. And generally, the budget battles that we've seen within Congress over the last couple of years have been challenging for funding across the board. And so, you know, global health has taken a bit of a hit as a result of that. And as the largest funder for global health R&D, when the U.S. government funding declines or stays stagnant for so long, it really shows. It has quite a significant impact on research and development.
Your group, the Global Health Technologies Coalition, has said that failure to guarantee funding, or especially to increase funding, could undermine two decades of landmark gains in global health. What types of programs, especially for a continent like Africa, would be most at risk?
We will see a decline in progress, and which is disappointing. We've made great progress in global health as a result of the investments that we've made. You know, we've seen a 58% reduction in malaria mortality. We've seen a 45% reduction in maternal mortality since 1990. And those kinds of progress markers are going to backslide. They're going to, you know, we're going to lose that progress if we don't continue to make these investments. And we have, you know, big goals ahead of us. We've, you know, set out to eliminate, to see an end to the HIV/AIDS epidemic, to eliminate some neglected tropical diseases, to end malaria. And we're not going to reach those goals without investments in new R&D and continued investment and continued progress. And so that backslide is what we're worried about.
Some have proposed in recent weeks that emergency funds for Ebola R&D be redirected for Zika research. Is that a plausible way of coping with funding shortages needed to meet new emergencies?
It's really not. It's a really unacceptable way to fund the response to these types of epidemics and emergencies. You know, we aren't in the clear with Ebola. We're not done. We haven't solved the problem. We still don't have the tools we need to fight Ebola. And so we risk a lot by moving that money to fight the next public health crisis. And you know, unfortunately, Zika happened very shortly after Ebola, and we weren't necessarily finished with that. And we don't know what's coming next. And so moving funds around from one public health crisis to the next is an unsustainable way to address global health issues.
What are some of the solutions that you're proposing?
We have three main sort of goals that we outline in the report. And the first goal, or the first sort of marker for the U.S. government, is really to sustain investments. As we've talked about, the need is there for sustained investment in global health R&D and for continued investment. And, you know, we can't make progress without public funding for global health R&D, but we also need to think about new ways to incentivize R&D. Public funding isn't enough, so that means getting the private sector involved and coming up with ways to build those relationships, public-private partnerships that we can use to invest in research and development for new tools and technologies. And the second is really improved coordination and alignment within the U.S. government. You know, each agency plays a key role in global health R&D, and getting those agencies to work really closely together is a really effective strategy for better using the dollars that we do have. So it doesn't always have to be about new money. It can be about better using the dollars that we have. And we saw this happen with the response to Ebola, where there was great coordination between USAID and CDC and the Department of Defense around the Ebola grand challenges to solicit new innovations to help stop the Ebola outbreak. And that was a really effective coordinating mechanism. And that type of mechanism should exist, you know, outside of a public health crisis.
And that's Erin Wilmorton, the head of the Global Health Technologies Coalition in Washington, D.C. She was speaking with reporter William Eagle. The Associated Press says senior U.S. government officials are urging Chad to take action to ensure long-term stability for the country and the region. Visiting the Central African country this week are the top UN envoy of the U.S., Samantha Power, and the U.S. Commander of Special Operations in Africa, Brigadier General Donald Boldu. The AP says in meetings with the Chadian President, Idriss Deby, the U.S. officials stressed the threat of a growing relationship between two terrorist groups, Boko Haram and the Islamic State. Boldu said earlier this month, N'Djamena intercepted weapons from Libya intended for the Lake Chad region. Samantha Power said economic development, jobs, and political inclusiveness would help guarantee stability in Chad and the region. She criticized government actions during elections 2 weeks ago in which President Debe ran for a fifth term. The government shut down the internet and text messaging during the polls. Meanwhile, opponents say 60 security forces who voted against Debe have disappeared. But the Chadian leader said there were no disappearances. And he also suggested he would not support U.S. efforts to install a unity government in Libya, where Islamic extremists are trying to establish a presence. Debbie said the international community's efforts to establish a functioning government of national unity in Libya will fail. The Gambia heads to presidential and parliamentary elections towards the end of this year. Many opposition parties are forming alliances to compete against incumbent Yahya Jammeh, who is running for another fifth term. The polls take place December 1st. One new opposition party that is hoping to make a difference is the Gambia Moral Congress, GMC. Reporter Alpha Jallo caught up with GMC Secretary General Mai Ahmed Fati in Dakar. He began by asking him about the challenges of forming a political party in the Gambia.
It has become worse now because we have an Election Amendment Act 2015, and under this law, the conditions that are necessary for the formation of a political party have been revised upwards and rendered more draconian. In order to form a party, now you need at least minimum 5,000 signatures of voters who must subscribe to it, and you need at least 1,000 from each of the regions, at least 1,000, nearly 1,000 almost from the regions, in order to have that. You also have to pay $1 million to fees to the Gambia government, which has been increased 300 to 400%. Previously, it was only about $10,000. Previously also to form a party, you need basically about 500 signatures. That has been increased, like I said, to 5,000. And you need it sparsely distributed all over the region, all the seven regions of the country. Then also you have to have a statute. But under the current circumstance, it's almost impossible for anybody to form a new party based on these conditions. Because when you start getting the signatures, the NIA will definitely intervene and people will be afraid to come forward.
Now, is your party, the Gambia Moral Congress, very visible on the political scene of the country?
Of course. We have been involved in elections, 2011 in particular. The party team up with the United Democratic Party. We formed what is called United Alliance, in which Honorable Usainu Dabo was our presidential candidate and I was the vice presidential running mate by our agreement. So we have been very active in the electoral process. We have also been campaigning around the country different intervals. We have branches in all of the seven regions of the country. We have offices in all seven regions of the country. We have members and committees across different parts of the country. We are active, we are alive, we are involved in every major government opposition activity. We also have our own activity. So our party is very active on the ground.
Now, are you quite confident of making any success where large and more established parties fail?
Yes. In politics, everything is possible. You will see the example I'll give you is just Senegal alone. President Macky Sall created a party in less than a year. He was able to form a government against more grounded parties like the PDS and also the PS, which have been in existence for 40 to 60 years. So the length of a party or its financial strength is not always a determinant of success. It is the people. When the people are impressed by your mandate, by your program, they follow you. And we feel that right now in the ground in the country, the only party or the party that appeals most to most people is our own party, GMC, because it is the party of change. It is the party considered by young people, very energetic, with a very vibrant program that is promising and that can save the Gambia. So our success really is depending on the people, and we have a lot of confidence in our people.
Now, what makes your party, the Gambia Moral Congress, different from other political parties in the Gambia?
The difference is our emphasis on the word moral. We believe that politics has to have a moral content. It is because politics is devoid of morality. That is why politics has a bad name. Tell anyone today you are a politician, and immediately they will describe you as dishonest, they will describe you as a cheat, they will describe you as a liar, they will describe you as unreliable. Politics has a bad name today because politicians are involved in conduct that is deplorable, that is dishonorable, that is denounceable. And that is why we feel that morality should be at the heart of political debate, because when we are able to use politics with morality, we will be able to change attitude. We will change the rule of the game, and we will have politics with compassion that is more sincere, that is more honest, and that is more prone to public service than selfish service. That is our difference. Our emphasis on restoring core values, on governance based on moral values. That is our difference.
Now, as Gambia heads to election towards the end of this year, many people will believe that you are here in Dakar perhaps to canvass for votes from the Gambian exile community here.
Well, the Gambian exile community are Gambians. If we canvass votes for them, that would be legitimate. But suddenly, Senegal is like a second home to me. Like most Gambians, we have families in Senegal. So I am in Senegal. I'm in the right place. I'm in my second home. Many Gambians crisscross through Senegal. I'm here for that, both sometimes official, sometimes private. But suddenly, it's also an opportunity to access our citizens who are here, to get to know what their problems are, to listen to them and how to resolve some of those difficulties. At the same time, to seek their political support. This is also imperative.
My Ahmed Fati, Secretary General of Gambia Moral Congress, GMC, speaking to reporter Alpha Jallo. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
voaafrica.com.
On voaafrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
voaafrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.